Well, welcome everybody. We have a dream guest for you today, really. And if you'd have asked us 5-6 years ago when we started this podcast, who would be at the top of our wish list? I mean, this man would come very, very close, if not be at the tops. Look, Evan Jaeger, it's an honor. Olympic silver medalist back in 2016 and World Champ bronze medalist in 2017. How do you look at your career now you're retired?
Almost like two parts, kind of.
Okay.
First half, healthy, lot of success, pretty much just positive momentum the whole time. And then second half, kind of big injury cycle. Never fully got out of it. And performance definitely took a hit, and it was a lot less fun than just kind of having success all the time and feeling like unbeatable. But I think it was good for me in the long run. It is what it is. It's not going to be perfect. Two parts.
Well, hopefully we can break down those two parts on the podcast today. And I just want to ask, though, before we get into it, what are you doing now? Obviously, you're based in Stockholm. How's that transition been into everyday life as a sort of normal civilian now, if you like?
Yeah, it's been pretty seamless, honestly. Very smooth, way smoother than anything I was expecting. I was pretty sure that I was going to struggle pretty bad with kind of the next stage of life. I'd heard a lot about professional athletes retiring and struggling because it's just a complete switch from what they've been doing. And I knew like how much I loved the professional athlete lifestyle and the work that goes into it and the lifestyle and the traveling and everything really about it. And I was pretty sure that it was going to be a struggle. And I think like I really only spent like probably like 6 weeks like not knowing what I was going to be doing. Probably less, 4 weeks not knowing what I was going to be doing, and 6 weeks in between like my last race of the season and starting work at Nomeo. And it honestly just like happened very smooth and quick, and I don't think I could have asked for a better job after my like professional career. So it's like, yeah, it's been pretty awesome. Definitely not without like hiccups and some tough times, but it's been very nice.
Yeah, when you were professional, you don't strike me as someone who was thinking about what's next. I feel like you were very focused on what you were doing, even right up until obviously you retired. So, yeah, my question was going to be, had you ever sort of thought about what you were doing? Like, did you think you'd be working at a company like Nomeo when you retired? What options did you have on the table?
Yeah, I think it changed a lot over my career. I never really, like you said, I never really put too much thought into it. I'm very much like a all in, all out type of person. Like during the track season, I'm like all in doing everything that I can, and then during the off season I try to like fully check out and like be anti-professional. So I had a hard time bringing myself to like really sit down and think about what the next step was going to be, because I didn't want to like open the door a little bit and take anything away from my like competitive side. So yeah, in the back of my head I had thought about a couple of things, like I don't know, going kind of sports med at some point early on, and then that kind of went away and I started thinking a little more seriously about coaching, and then a little bit about like, I mean, there's a pretty nice open door at Nike for Nike athletes. I was, you know, living in Portland my whole career. So I think that would have been like a very feasible option had I wanted to go that route. But, you know, ultimately, like we made the decision to move out here before I was done. So those kind of options were thrown out the window. And obviously, like, Nomeo's brand new, so I had never even thought about that. So my mindset was like, basically either coaching or Nike. So it was a pretty stressful time when, like, I basically decided to retire between end of the season and, like, getting this job. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do because Nike's not here, and the coaching, like, the running scene is way different than it is in the States. They don't have, like, the universities and everything, so it's just way different. So it was a little stressful at that time, but yeah, it all worked out, and I'm, like, super, super happy.
Mm. Are you still training a bit? I follow you on Strava. You're still training to some degree. What for, may I ask?
Yeah, good question. I like was fully ready to just completely stop. And yeah. I did that for like a few weeks after the season, and was always like the type of person where I was like, there's no way I'm doing workouts when I'm done running. Like I'll run for the rest of my life because I just love running, but there's no way I'm doing workouts. And then I started this job and they're like, oh, you're not running. Like, you're like our runner. Like, you need to be running. So I was like, oh, okay. So I started running with the guys that like a few of them like run like almost every day. So I started running with them, and then started jumping into some of their workouts. And then they're like, oh, we're going to do this road. We're sponsoring a road 10K in April. You should pace like our like fastest section. So I was like, all right, I'll try. So I started training for that specifically. And so I've been tasked with like pacing the sub 28 10K group. So like I have to do some like serious training. Like I ideally want to get at least 5K through like 28 pace.
Wow.
My goal is like a 14 flat 5K and then try to go as far as I can. Yeah, did like a lot of just basic threshold training all winter, and then started doing some more serious workouts. And which I like never thought that I would do, honestly. But it's been so much fun. Like I realized after a little bit of time of not really training that I like was kind of going through like withdrawals, honestly. I was like missing training hard and working hard, and really enjoyed it when I like got back into it. So yeah, doing the pace job, and then like 2 weeks after that, two of the guys roped me into doing the Copenhagen marathon with them in May 10th. So I'm gonna do a marathon off of like 14 minute 5K training. So we'll see how it goes.
You're not pacing that. You're just gonna try and do it. You're going to try and finish it.
Yeah, that's first goal is to try and finish. But one of the guys on the team wants to run 2:30. So yep. I'm going to try to help him. I don't know what I'm going to be able to do, but I'm going to try to just run with him and see if we can make that happen between the two of us.
Brilliant. Brilliant. We'll look out for that result. let's rewind then to right at the beginning. I say the beginning, basically your college career, because obviously that was cut short. You got a pro a year after with Jerry Schumacher. And I think obviously he was a huge part of your life and will come up in conversation today. But what was it about Jerry that made you commit to him for your whole professional career and initially obviously follow him to turn professional as well?
Decision to go to Wisconsin for college and follow him was, he had like a great program at Wisconsin. They were super successful, a lot of good guys on the team, which is like, that's obviously a huge draw for someone going into college. You want someone to push you to make you better. But it really came, I mean, you know, there's lots of college programs that would have offered that. So what it really came down to was Jerry just like, I think I knew he was a good coach, and he just got me really, really excited, more than any of the other coaches, to like reach my potential, basically. Like anytime we talked about the future or what it had entailed, like I just got this enthusiasm and energy from him that like made me, like I had big dreams already, but he like was like, yeah, we'll do that. And like he almost made me want to like dream even bigger. So that was a huge part of it. And Yeah, we had like a good connection, athlete, coach. I had met him a couple times doing a Wisconsin summer cross country camp, so I got to know him a little bit. So I think that played into it too. But yeah, I think his like enthusiasm more than anything just got me really excited for the future.
He must have seen something in you as well to allow you to go pro, because obviously it's well documented. You're a strong NCAA runner, made NCAA finals, but you were 341, and to turn pro at 341 for 1500 is crazy. Obviously now people will be listening. Yeah. Like, what the hell?
Yeah.
It was still, 341 was still quick back then.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean the decision, I don't feel like I had earned like a professional contract at the time. Jerry definitely, I think, like, he must have like sold me a bit to Nike, thinking that I could do something really good in the future. So he definitely went to bat for me there. And, but yeah, I mean, 341 is, especially today's standards, like, I don't know anyone that would be able to get a professional contract. Like, you'd have to be like 13 years old these days to get a professional contract at 341. But yeah, it must have showed something, and I believed in myself, so I like had full faith that it was going to work out, and it was making the right decision, and I could make it work at the next level. Yeah,
yeah. I think, you know, reading up on it, that situation, Jerry was quoted to say, you don't just have the physical skill set, but you have the mind for it. And so I'm intrigued how you viewed yourself as a runner back then, and also how you viewed the sport and your future.
Yeah, I think more than anything, I just like I knew that running was just going to be my life, like at that point. Obviously, like, injuries can happen or whatever, but yeah, as soon as I...
Is there anything that made you think that?
Or just like... Can't put your finger on it. Yeah, just like utter belief, I guess, in myself. Yeah. Nothing really more. I mean, I was very successful in high school. I was one of the best guys in the country, both junior and senior year. So I had the success to kind of back it up and give me that confidence. And there was, I mean, basically... For a big part of my career, like, I set my sight on something, I set goals, and I achieved those goals. And it just seemed very natural that whatever I was like gonna hope for and shoot for was gonna happen. It's just like how it kind of played out. And I think as soon as I like signed my letter of intent to go to Wisconsin, it was like, okay, it was like, I'm going to run at Wisconsin for 4 to 5 years, and then I'm going to go pro. And like that, this is going to be like my next step towards running professionally. And it was just like kind of cemented in my mind. And I was, I think, already dreaming about medaling at the Olympics, like at that time. And so, and it just like, I don't know, I just in my mind just saw a path to it happening and was like, it's just going to happen. Just like how I thought about it. And so I think I must have told Jerry kind of some of my big goals, and I don't know if that was what convinced him or the way that I like approached things. I think I had those goals, and then more than anything, it was just like I just loved running, and that just consumed me, basically. I was just like, this is what I'm going to do until like I'm 30 or 35. And
I guess you could argue your transition to a professional was quite easy because you kept with the same coach and everything like that. But did the training change? Obviously, you're at Wisconsin for a year. The way Jerry was as a college coach, did he then change as a professional coach? Did the training change, or was it very similar? And was he the same guy?
It was similar. We like turned things, especially for myself, but I think for the rest of the guys too. Jerry turned things up a notch when we moved out to Portland. For myself, especially, I came into my freshman year injured and missed the cross country season. And so I focused on the 1500 that first year, even though we both kind of felt that the 5K was going to be my eventual event. So I was pretty low mileage, doing, you know, a lot of speed stuff, faster stuff than maybe the 5, 10K guys on the team. So I think I was probably topping out at 60, 65 miles a week. And then we moved out to Portland and I started running like 90 miles a week, like right away, basically. And obviously going from doing maybe like 10K of work for, on like strength training days in college to 10 miles of work, and it's faster. You know, I'm training with Selinsky and Tegenkamp, guys that were already like international class guys. And so everything was turned up. I mean, volume, intensity, our like gym days, like core work, everything was like longer, harder. And yeah, I mean, I struggled a ton. Like I just struggled on daily training runs most of the time because I was so tired. And like we were doing our daily training runs, like getting down to 6 minute or 5:40 almost every day. So it was a lot, big transition. But I was able to, you know, kind of absorb all that training from the fall, winter, early spring, and then started touching on some faster track stuff in the summer. And it just like, yeah, everything kind of just came together perfectly for me.
He's a tough coach and he has an old school approach. I don't know if he's still got it. I don't know if his coaching's changed. We'll get into that. But why do you just think that that sort of methodology works so well on you? That like, no, we're just going to go hard. You know, I feel like in this day and age, if someone's struggling on easy runs, everyone's like, okay, let's back off. Like, and I think that's where the whole thresholds change the game a little bit. We don't see many operate in that way anymore.
No. Yeah, definitely not. He's definitely changed. He's always evolving as a coach, which I think makes him such a great coach. It's like he doesn't have like a structure that was same year to year. We were always changing like a little something. But he's definitely still old school. I think it probably worked for me because I didn't know any better. Like that was still mostly the mentality like for everyone on the scene at the time. Like, a lot of like old school training, like just working really hard for the most part. Yeah, I didn't know any better. I think a big part of it is probably because I put 100% of my trust in Jerry and just knew that like he had the pedigree where like athletes ran well. I mean, the summer before I started my freshman year at college, Tegenkamp was like 0.03 seconds away from a bronze medal at the World Championships. So it was like, I was just like, I just have to do what he does and I'm going to get there. And so, a lot of belief. And then, like, definitely don't want to sell Jerry short at all. Like, he is one of the, like, I think he's one of the most brilliant minds in track and field. Yeah. The way he structures training on, like, a multi-year approach, a year approach, and then throughout the season, he's, like, exceptionally good at, like, getting everything to line up, like, at the right time. Peaking an athlete very well. And so, you know, I think the mindset was you're just going to work really hard, absorb as much training, get as strong as you can for the first 6 months. And then we're going to dial things back a little bit and you're just going to sharpen up and you're going to feel incredible. And that's just kind of exactly how things played out. And, you know, I bought into the process and thankfully didn't get injured during that time. And it just like, it just worked out. And yeah, it felt amazing, honestly.
You were very successful in 2009. You went to the World Championships. What were you, 21 years of age? Were you 21 in 2009?
No, I would have been 20. Yeah.
20. And you went to the World Championships in 2009 and in Bakili's prime. so that must have been an experience itself. And then you decided to switch to the steeple. And there's been many, I guess, debates on why you moved to the steeple. And you talk about You knew you were eventually going to be a 5,000 meter runner. Did you ever know you were going to be a steepler?
No, definitely didn't know. It like intrigued me a little bit. One of my high school coaches like suggested it before I had gone off to college. He's like, "Yeah, you should think about this event. I think you'd be good at it." So it was always in the back of my mind, which I think like kind of helped the transition like to the steeple. And made I was like had that curiosity, I guess, and like the excitement for the event. So yeah, I was always intrigued and curious. So when we started the training and the hurdling work and everything that goes into the steeple, when we started that, it just I was excited about it, and so like I worked really hard at trying to get everything perfect, and it just came super naturally to me. Honestly, I think in like 2 weeks, I felt like I had been hurdling for like a year, basically. Yeah, and each workout that I did just got better and better, and just had this like positive momentum of like good vibes, and like also getting better technically at the event, and fitness was improving, and yeah, just this huge positive snowball effect that kind of lasted for the whole season.
Would you do steeple workouts then?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, the first one was like entry level. It was just like 10 by 400 over 5 hurdles. So like no water jump, maybe even just 4 hurdles. No water jumping. And then I think every workout after that first year, I was doing water jumps and big reps. I did like mile reps over like hurdles and water jumps, and and obviously stuff changed over the years, but we tried to get that feeling of the steeple race in workouts as best we could, because there's kind of just nothing that really prepares you for what a steeple feels like until you actually get into it. So I think that was super helpful.
How did you handle the impact of that? Because what a lot of people don't realize, obviously you do five hurdles a lap, and and a water jump or whatever, you do 4K, you know, you're north of 70 odd hurdles in some of these sessions. Yeah. If you do a mile rep. So it's a lot of impact. It's a lot of jumps.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I was doing, I think like the hurdling, the technique stuff that I was doing probably helped a lot with that. I probably did 1 to 2 hurdling like technique sessions a week, probably from like October until like the spring. So that in itself is like a lot of jumping. Yeah. So I think that helped prepare me for everything. I think when you're doing it right and you're like really efficient at hurdling, you're not really jumping and landing all that much, if that makes sense. You're kind of just like taking the hurdle in stride, and it doesn't like if you're doing it right, it doesn't beat you up that much.
It's a fair point. I mean, you were definitely, you say you were a natural. I mean, that's, it also sounds like you were working at it a lot as well though.
I don't think I worked harder at it the rest of my career as I did that first year. We did like so much work. Yeah. Just, and then like, I think once I got the hang of it, it just felt so natural that we just needed to like touch on things. But for a lot of the first 2012 to 2016 or 17, we were trying to hurdle like once a week, basically. For a bulk of the year.
Talk about the impact of Pascal Debert, a guy that not many people will know of, especially this day and age. But yeah, I mean, there was Jerry and there was him, right? In the
yeah. Band. Yeah. Jerry, obviously, like everyone knows that he was the head coach. And so he gets, I think, way more of the recognition. But for the steeple specifically, like, Pascal was like way more influential on my steeple career than Jerry was. I mean, Jerry, you know, he wrote up the training that I did, but like, Pascal, he like pushed me to make everything perfect. And I think that's why the first year was so successful, and the years and the training days when like I didn't want to put the work in, or like, you know, it was like 40 degrees and raining in the winter and I was already like cold and stiff and everything. He was still dragging me out there. So, he taught me how to hurdle. He taught me how to water jump. We went through like, you know, race scenarios and just mentality around the steeple. And I think him and Jerry both kind of together collectively came up with the steeple workouts. He was in my corner the most for sure when we were working together. And yeah, he was by far the most influential person, like for my steeple specific career. Yeah.
He just would do a lot of technical work with you.
Yeah. He started me off, like he taught me how to like stretch. He taught me how to do the standing drills. He taught me how to, he gave me the routine that I carried with me for my entire career, for like pre workout or pre race, and the technical aspect. Like, yeah, I might have like, I don't know, like naturally been good without any coaching, but like definitely I wouldn't have the technique that I did without him. Like he made sure like all my like feet angles were like perfect. He had me like thinking about specific like, yeah, foot and ankle and hip and knee angles and like takeoff point before the hurdle and how to approach the water jump. And he would be, it was very annoying at times because like I just didn't, I don't know, he like was on my ass so much about it. So it's like when you're tired and like, yeah, you're like drained from training, you don't want to be doing all this stuff, but he was dragging me out there and making sure I did things like perfect all the time, at least to the best of our abilities. He, massive part.
And it was this, you know, on the face of it, it was a very smooth transition. You run a, it was 8:26, just your opener. That was your debut, 8:26 or something in that region. Yeah. And that same year you go to Olympic Games, 2012 finalist in this. I remember watching this, your heat, and thinking you looked so good in the heat. Did you struggle to sort of do those back-to-back races in the steeple? Because it does take a lot out of you. Or do you just think those boys had another gear in the final?
Yeah, they were just better than I was for sure. I mean, those guys, and the race, the final race, like still just like played into their strengths more than I played into mine. I mean, the big last 300, 400 in like a slow race was like never my strong suit. So even in like, I don't know, in like 2016 or 2017, if the race had played out the same way that London race had, Boy might have still beaten me by just as much, you know, because he was just like that good at that like style of racing. I just got fit enough to make sure that didn't happen in like 2016 and 2017. But it was I felt like at that time, and for most of my career, I was like the strongest athlete on the starting line for like aerobically and like longer distance wise. So I don't think the rounds affected me in a negative way at all. It's just like the racing style. And Kemboy was just, he's like the GOAT. So it's like, it's just hard to beat him. He's just very, very good.
Let's talk about the rivalries in sport. Very few have rivalries. I felt like you did have a rivalry against Kipruto, Kemboy, against the Kenyans. And you were competing in an era where actually team tactics was still quite prominent. And I don't know if you knew they were adopting team tactics. It certainly looked like that on the outside. And it always felt like it was sort of you. There was hope for us watching, because it was like you versus the Africans in a way. So there was always more on the line than just a title or just a time. I think that's why it was so exciting watching you race.
Yeah.
We don't see that anymore. So how did, you know, what were those conversations like with Jerry, with Pascal, and even yourself? Like, what, going into these championships, knowing that there was going to be three of them who could all do something erratic, something crazy that you had to cope with.
Yeah, we didn't really, I feel like the conversation of team tactics didn't come up a ton. It was more like, what can I do to like make the race, or like to just do as well as I can in the race. I think the good thing about that time period is like there was, along with the, like, it was like a healthy rivalry, I would say, between myself and the Kenyans. It was definitely a huge goal of mine to like to just break up the Kenyan dominance. That was like a top, it was like a top three goal of mine, basically. And it just, they just had such a stranglehold on the event that it was like, it seemed impossible. So that was like a very fun challenge for me. But I think what maybe played into my favor was like when I was like coming up and having success, another guy was as well, Conceslas Kipruto. And he was like the young stud, and Ezekiel Kemboy was like kind of at the later stage of his career and his success. And they were very similar runners. So I think there was a sense, maybe within Kenya or just the running community, that like Conceslas was the heir to the throne and he was going to overtake Kemboy and be the next king of the steeplechase, basically. So they actually had like a bit of a rivalry. So I don't think that they were really working together all that much to like benefit each other. They were like kind of looking at each other like over the shoulder to try and beat each other. So there wasn't like a ton of team tactics at that time, but like the intimidation factor was definitely there. It was like three or four Kenyans in the final that could all medal basically every time we stepped up to the line. And a lot of really good Kenyan steeplechasers like during that time period. Like,
yeah, it was almost their peak, wasn't it? It was just, they would get one through three, four. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, they went one through four in 15, and you know, you had Kemboy, you had Conceslas, who was like he won everything for a couple years. Jarius Biretch, who like won every single Diamond League race 1 year. Brimin Kipruto, who was second fastest all time, just a hundredth off the world record at the time. Paul Koech, who probably has the most sub-8 steeplechases of all time. So it was like, they were like just stacked. So it was super intimidating, but just still felt like I could make it happen at some point. Yeah.
Did it get to a point where you felt like they were fearing you a lot more? They were respecting who you were a lot more, and they were like, "How are we going to beat this guy?"
Yeah, I don't think I really got to that point until the Paris race in 2015. I think all of 2014, I got just like kind of demolished by Biretch in the Diamond League scene, and it was still very clear that he was still like a level above me, and then 2015, I had like, you know, really good year, almost won Paris. And I think after that Paris race, they were like, okay, like he's a challenger. We got to watch out for him. And so I think it actually like negatively affected me going into the World Championships, because I wanted to take the lead at Worlds in the final and make a push and try to like drag the race out and make it hard. But every time I tried to go to the front, like Conceslas just like he surged to hold me off. So it's like, if he didn't care about me, he would have probably just let me take the lead and just like do whatever I wanted. But he was actively trying to like hold me off from taking the lead. So yeah, I think definitely got to that status at that point. And yeah, for the next few years to come, I think people were always watching what I was doing.
They were. And were you ever watching what they were doing? Were you ever intrigued? Like, these guys were the best in the world. Did you ever try to find out what they were up to, how they were training, or were you just staying in your own lane, designing your own program?
Yeah, I was curious more than anything. I knew that, like, I mean, Jerry, I could have gone to Jerry and had suggestions about training, but he, like, you know, he has his way of training. So I don't think our entire philosophy would have changed. I maybe could have tweaked some workouts, some SIBO workouts here and there. I remember I did San Silvestre 10K, which is in Madrid, New Year's Eve 2015 going into 2016. And Kemboy was there. Ezekiel Kemboy was there. And I remember, like, you know, he was still the best guy in the world. And I was still kind of like up and coming. I remember, like, sitting down with him and, like, asking him about, like, racing and, like, training and being like, dude, how do you do this? Like, I just got to know. And he gave me some answer that I don't think, like, actually gave me that much information. But I remember still being, like, hungry for information.
Yeah.
And I knew a little bit about Conceslas because our agents are kind of like co-partners a little bit within work. And so, like, I spent some time with him over the summers, actually. I remember during, like, Be Rich's, like, heyday, like, seeing some stuff about him on Let's Run. And, like, he did some, I think, crazy 2x mile workout over barriers at, like, 7,000 feet in Kenya. And he ran, like 420 or something at altitude. And I just remember being like, oh God, like, he's, like, pretty strong right now. So yeah, definitely looking to them, but I don't think I, like, really changed all that much other than just trying to get better in all aspects so that I could, like, beat them somehow.
What did Kemboy tell you at that 10K? Can you remember?
Yeah, I remember for sure. I asked him, I was like, because, you know, he's got such an amazing kick. I was like, dude, how do you approach a race to be able to kick like this? Like, I don't have it. Like, I just can't do it like you, obviously. And he basically was just like, yeah, I break the race up into thirds. I just check out the first third of the race. And then the second third of the race I used to, like, move up. So you're still not really spending any, like, mental energy. And then I don't think about, like, racing until the last third. And my goal is to just wait until 300 to go. And then just, that's when I, like, really start racing. Whereas, like, I think because I didn't have that skill set, I, like, had to be actively, like, mentally engaged and racing from very far out. And I think my tactics kind of showed that, like, when I was, like, at my peak.
Mm. Absolutely. And I feel like your results, you broke up that Kenyan dominance and now they're not as dominant. And do you reflect on that now and wonder why haven't they got many people coming through anymore? Where have they all gone?
I think that's, like, across the board in the track. They were, yeah. I mean, it was like 5K, 10K steeple, and, like, even 15. You're like, there's going to be at least one Kenyan meddling in all of those events, if not, like, multiple medals. But I mean, you just look at it across the board and it's not the case. I think a big part of it is most likely, like, the money, the draw to go to the roads that I think is just pulling a lot of talent and focus away from the track into the roads for the Kenyans. There could be, like, a lot of things. It could be, like, you know, tightening down on the drug testing. It could be they're just, yeah, focusing more on the roads. It could be they've lost like the mental edge that they had, or just like the rest of the world is just catching up to their level and now things are just more competitive. So I don't know. I don't think there's any one reason why, but I definitely don't think it's like
it's not you.
No, I don't think it's because of me.
Right. Well, we're 40 minutes in. We haven't spoken enough about Paris 2015, the famous 8-minute clocking. I was there with a co-host in the stadium. It was probably the whole crowd gasping on that last barrier. Incredible day, incredible race, one of the best. I mean, looking back on it now, like when you reflect, why do you think you were never able to go quicker? I'm sure you've been asked this a million times.
Yeah, I think, I mean, a big part of it is just like, sometimes things just have to like line up perfectly for you. I think that's what happened in that race. Like the lead up, like I was super, super fit. I like had this kind of change of mindset going into the race that I was just going to go with the pace no matter what it was. Like it did, I was going to get right behind Bjerg. And that wasn't something, the type of mindset that I had going into that race wasn't something that I had for a lot of races before then. And then just so happens that like, you know, takes the pace out. I feel good, which is like a big part of it. Like we have like really good pacing all the way until 900 to go. I didn't go into the lead until 900 to go. And just a lot of positive excitement and emotion like leading up to that point. I definitely think I could have run faster like at different points in my career. I think I raced Monaco twice after that. I think 2017 and 2018. I think I ran 8:01 twice in Monaco, and I think I could have broken 8 at both of those races had things played out a little differently. But kind of almost after that moment, after Paris 2015. For the most part, anytime I did like a Diamond League, I was like, when I was fit enough to break 8 and wanting to run fast, I was the one like requesting the pace and going out behind the rabbit. And one of the times I had to lead from like a K out. And the other time I think I had to lead from maybe even further out. And the pace was slower. And so I had to, there's a lot of factors. I think 2017 in particular was, had like a 2:35 last K, and like I could have broken 8 for sure that day had pacing been a little bit better and there would have been someone to challenge me maybe. But yeah, things just, they don't always play out perfectly. So, it's super unfortunate because like after that race at Paris, I was like, obviously super pissed because I knew I like kind of missed a huge opportunity, but I was like, well, I'm definitely going to break 8 at some point. So like, you know, just have to wait for it, you know? But it just, just never played out that way, unfortunately.
You raced pretty sparingly throughout your career. That was a theme of Bowman Track Club in its heyday. Do you regret not racing as much?
I think not. For the way that we trained, I don't think so. I think it would have been more fun, obviously, to race more. But I don't know. I think like I would have had to do like a lot of stuff differently to race super frequently. I do think part of the reason, or like me racing so infrequently, led to me being like very consistent. And I feel like for the most part, every time I stepped onto the track, I got the most out of myself and I was running pretty close to my best, maybe at the time. But I would prefer to have raced more for sure. I think just the way that we were doing things, we were training very, very hard in between races to make sure that we were like ready for really big opportunities when we did race and always be like on our A game when we raced. So
what do you reckon your talking of 2015, the Olympics after that, the World Championships after that, what was your best race?
My best race? I actually think like athletically, performance-wise, my best race is probably like Paris, honestly. Just like everything except for the last hurdle was perfect, honestly. So I don't think on the day, I don't think I could have gotten any more out of myself unless I had like, I think I had to like back off a little bit, like the last lap to ensure not falling on the last barrier. But like up until that point, I poured like everything I had into that like performance. And it was like a perfect race, honestly, before then. So that I think might take the cake. I think mentality wise, like Rio is probably like the best. Like I've never been more chill for like a big race in my life than I was for that race. It was just like, yeah, I was so calm, and I think that allowed me to run really well there that day. And obviously it was like big moment, and like I led, I don't know, like almost four laps of the race and ran 8:04 in like 90-95 degree heat and like at the Olympics. So that was like a really, really good one. Just obviously it like got like was no match for Conceslus that day. So
he was a special runner, wasn't he? I mean, he was he was a bit of a enigma. Second half of your career, these injuries just come and it's almost like, what could have been? If you were to do your career again, can you pinpoint a reason why you would get injured so much and why it was so stop start for you in your last few years?
I mean, I think coming off of the 2017 season, I was pretty bummed about like feeling like I took a step back from like 2016 and 2015. So I was like, oh, what do I need to do? What do I need to change to like keep improving and get better? So like I ran a lot of big mileage that like winter. I was trying to run like 100 miles a week instead of more like 90. Yeah, like I felt really good while I was doing it, but I think it took away a little something from the steeple, like the pop that I had, and then like started like a pretty long injury journey that 2018 season that like kind of started in May and just ran through a lot of different small aches and pains and small injuries that ended up resulting in like I tore my iliacus muscle on the left side like 10 days before the Diamond League final, and was like told that it was like a, you know, pain management thing, like you could race, like if you could deal with it. It would like, when I hear that, I'm like, okay, like I'm gonna tough it out. So I raced on it, and then in that race I got like an impact fracture in my foot, and you know, didn't take enough time off in the fall to let everything heal and try to start training again, and then took some more time off, tried to start training again, took some more time off, and was like, okay, like I just gotta start training now, because it's like it's been way too long and things don't feel like I was like, oh, maybe it's just like some lingering pain, but it's all healed. And so I basically ran on like a stress fracture in my foot for like 6 months, from, you know, like October until April. And then got another MRI, and it was like, oh, this bone is still fractured. So that like ingrained like a ton of compensation problems that like I'm kind of like still dealing with to this day. So, I mean, that was the root of the reoccurring injuries. I think I did a lot to mess my body up during that time, and would be like healthy enough to train like kind of the rest of my career, but was never like 100% healthy.
Man, is that just the pressure of being who you were at that time? You just felt like you always you could never have a year off?
Yeah, the next year was like World Champs year. And I guess it's just like, didn't have the confidence to just, take time off and let it heal. And I didn't have anyone telling me to do that either. So that didn't help. Just like a lot of bad decisions, obviously. And ultimately, if it falls on me, I think like as an athlete, you need to know yourself and like know what you should and shouldn't be dealing with. And like I knew something was wrong, but I just couldn't make that decision like at the time.
Through all of that, Bowman's changing quite a lot as well. Like, you know, you were in 15, 16, 17, this peak era of Bowman, everyone was just ripping and it was still producing amazing results in Team 20, but you know, obviously Shelby happened.
Yeah.
Jerry gets a job at Oregon. There was a lot of change. And when that was going on, did you sort of start to lose that belief in getting back? Do you have to readjust the goalposts a little bit?
For myself?
Yeah.
No, I was pretty delusional until the end, I would say. I would say like 2019, I was mostly injured. 2020, I was, the COVID, I got back to, I think I ran 13-12 that year. And so I was like, I'm still fit enough. Like I can still like have, if I have like another full healthy year, like I should be like pretty fit and like good to go. Like, I should still be the best in the US and make the team and be in contention for medals, basically, was how I was thinking. And then, 21, got injured, tore my gas or my soleus. And then 22 was Eugene. So I made the team again. And then at that point, I was like, I'm probably not meddling anymore. But if I like stay healthy for the rest of my career, I can still win USAs and make world teams. I was basically like, if I can stay healthy, I was like, I'll do this until 25 and then I'll be done. And I thought I could still do pretty well. And so it wasn't, I probably still thought that way until 2024. And I probably still thought I could win the trials going into 2024. Yeah.
Did you like the limelight? Obviously, early parts of your career, you were under a lot of scrutiny and everything like that, and you were a massive name, but we actually didn't see much of you. Like, you were always quite reserved. Obviously, no one really knew how you guys train at Bowman, but everyone just knew the results you were having. And then I guess over time, we've seen more of you. So when you were in your prime, were you sort of doing everything you can to stay away from the limelight and, like you say, just be fully locked in on what you were doing?
Yeah, I would say it's weird. Even in high school, I didn't like attention from people that I knew. I always felt really, really uncomfortable when like people that I knew like congratulated me and like, celebrated me for like accomplishments. It made me really uncomfortable, but like I did kind of like a little bit of attention from the outside. But I would say for like my professional career, it was more of like, we just like didn't, I think because we were so good, we like kind of wanted to keep all the secrets and we just wanted to just dominate everyone basically. And so we tried to keep like a lot of the outside out basically. And like also like, social media wasn't a thing for the first like half of my career. So there was not many ways for you to kind of put stuff out there, like yourself. Twitter started, I think, when I was already a pro, like 3 years of being a pro, and then Twitter came out, It was like, it was a huge, huge shift over the course of my career. But I think more than anything, it was kind of just like team culture to like, yeah, try to protect what we were doing, I guess. And it, you know, that's the funny thing. It's like everyone's doing something different and everyone's still really good. Like now, like tons of people are doing double threshold and everyone, like there's a lot of people doing the same training. But I mean, you look at like Cole Hawker and he's not doing the same type of training that like Jimmy Cressier is, like, or like Andreas Ahlgren. And it's like, he's still really good. So you could be very good doing things lots of different ways. So it doesn't actually matter what other people are doing as long as you're like optimizing what you're doing and believe in what you're doing. I would say more than anything, it was just like sign of the times.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you still protective of your training now?
No. Everything's out there on Strava. It's not super interesting and definitely not as sexy.
I mean, obviously you're training now. I meant your training. Yeah.
I could talk about that. Yeah. All day. It's fun.
You spoke about Berich's workout 2x1. What was your workout that you would go to in a summer, peak steeple, peak championship season, that would just give you an indication of where you're at?
Yeah, that was the thing about Jerry. We didn't really, like I said, he was always like changing things and like growing as a coach. We didn't really have like a go-to session that was like, if you do this session in this time, like this is indicative of this fitness. We had that a little bit for like 5K sessions, but yeah. I didn't really feel like I had that for the steeple. It was kind of always a combination of the different things. And for the 5K, like our big one was always mile 12.84 mile with like, I think it would be like 2 minutes rest at sea level, 3 minutes rest at altitude. At like race pace or faster. For the steeple, I did lots of different stuff. I would do like 800, 100 jog, 300 tail, like over barriers. I had done 3x K and then some fast like 600s after that. But for the most part, it was always some combination of like 800 to 1200 meter reps, making up over race distance, and at like goal race pace or faster. And I always felt like if I could do something like that, eights or Ks or 12s, and like quite a bit of them at altitude, at like 8 flat or faster, I was like, I know I'm in good shape. I think everyone's got to figure themselves out. I realize like I get more out of myself in races than I do in workouts. So like if I'm able to like work out at a certain level, I always feel confident in being able to race at that level or faster.
How often would you hit race pace then in the winter months, in the sort of spring training under Jerry's program? Would you guys be operating at 5K pace once a week, once every couple of weeks, or would you not touch it for a long period?
Yeah, I think it would be mostly base. Like race pace, like my mind goes to like race or like a 5K specific workout where it's, you're not just race running like 5K pace. You're doing it for like bigger reps that are like a little more indicative of like the actual race. So we wouldn't really do it like during the buildup up until January. We would never do really like anything like that usually. And then going into the indoor season, you would do like kind of like a quick hit of that at like when we go up to altitude for like 6 weeks. So it would maybe be like 6 to 8 weeks of doing that kind of thing in the winter, and then maybe like another couple of weeks of like more base stuff after the indoor season. And then basically like all summer, you're just doing that. And it's usually like we would go to like a 10-day cycle and do that like every 10 days, like over this, like May through the rest of the summer. And you know, that would, those paces would change like a little bit, like as you got fitter. Obviously, you're not going to be trying, like Mo would be, I would be trying to do like 8 flat to like 7:55 type workouts in like April or May. Like I would always start off at like maybe like 8:06, 8:08 type stuff. So I would be more like, you know, 5s or 66s early season, and then work down to like 63s, 64s by the end of the season.
Wow. Well, look, we're going to finish up, but I've got to ask, who's going to be, who's going to break 8 minutes? Who's going to be the next man outside of Africa? Will we see someone break it in the near future? And who do you think that might be? First non-African? Yeah,
I mean, we'll definitely see it for sure. I mean, everything's just getting better. So it's like, you know, it's going to happen. I would probably say my, like my betting money would go to Rupert from Germany. I think he's the closest, and I think he, at least a couple of races, has showed to have that like mentality towards like racing. There's, you know, there's a number of guys that are close, obviously, but it's, you know, it's hard to do. Like sometimes things just like have to line up well for you, and you got to have usually like at least one other guy going for that, or at least it makes it easier, you know.
Absolutely. Well, look, Evan, it's been an absolute pleasure, and a pioneer in a steeplechase, the man who could have changed that event forever, especially from a European and an American standpoint. So thanks very much, and we'll let you have a great weekend.
Yeah, thanks for having me.